Last week we began talking about chapter 7 and the book of Exodus, and we're going to complete that today. I just want to recap a few of the things that we talked about last week. The Exodus event is the central event of Jewish history. It is the event that defines everything that they are. Everything that comes before that, from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and all of it, leads up to the Exodus event, and then everything else in their history flows out of that experience. We're going to be talking today about the Sinai Covenant. In one of the very first sessions, we looked at the fact that there are seven covenants that are spoken of in the Scriptures, six from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament, and that they're all these particular relationships that God enters into with His people. But when we speak of the covenant of the Old Testament, it's the Sinai Covenant. That's what it's about. Even when we talk about the Old Testament or the New Testament. The word testament means the same thing as covenant. And so we talk about the Old Testament, we are talking about the Old Covenant, that's the Sinai Covenant. When we're talking about the New Testament, we're talking about the New Covenant in Christ's blood that is won for us by His death and resurrection. So this defines who they are as a people. We were slaves in Egypt, and God rescued us. God led us into through 40 years of wandering in the desert to the promised land, and He gave us that promised land. He took us, before the Exodus event, the Jewish people, were not the Jewish people. They had not yet taken on that title. They were the Hebrews. And they were a loose confederation of people who were tribally akin to one another. They knew that they were connected to one another, but there was no religion as such at this point. There is no formal religion anyway. There is no nation at this point. There is no structure to their society. They are slaves in Egypt. And so it is the Exodus event that takes this group of people and forms them into a people, forms them into a nation, and gives them what we know as the Jewish religion. So all of that happens here in the book of Exodus. Now again, I think this to me is one of the most important facts about the book of Exodus. The primary character, the primary actor in the book of Exodus is God. That is not true of every other book. In fact, I would say it is the only book in which we would say that God is the only, as the primary actor. God is obviously important in all of the books of the Bible. Everything that happens in all of the books of the Bible is in relationship to God and into God's revelation. But what we have here in the book of Exodus is God is the one who is most active. He is the character who is at the center of this book. He is not simply someone that they are talking about, that they are relating to, that they are reflecting on. He is the one that is acting. We see He shows up, what a grand entrance, with a burning bush. All right, that's a pretty dramatic way to start your presence, to reveal yourself in the burning bush to Moses. And then through the plagues, He is fighting on behalf of the Hebrew people. He is the one that is going to defeat Pharaoh. It's not going to be Moses. It's not going to be Aaron. It's not an uprising of the Jewish people, the Hebrew people. It is God who is at war with Egypt, and especially as we saw last week, with the gods of Egypt. It is God who is going to bring that 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, and who is then going to lead the Hebrews out from slavery. They're going to come to what we usually call the Red Sea, which is actually the Reed Sea. He is going to divide the Reed Sea. He is going to allow the Hebrews to pass over, and then the Egyptians are going to be destroyed there. He is going to show up in an even more dramatic way at Mount Sinai, and He is going to then reveal to Moses and through Moses to the people His law, His covenant. So He is the one that He's going to feed them in the desert with manna and with quail and with water from the rock. It is God who is primarily active in this book. And that is important to understand this particular book. Where we left off last week was we had just talked about the Passover meal that the people were to celebrate, and the death of the firstborn. And the Egyptians had said finally to the Hebrew people, get out, go. And God had told Moses to have the people then to ask their neighbors, to ask the Egyptians for jewelry, for gold, for silver, in order to have money and possessions. And they gave it to them. They said, just get out. Just get out. You and your God, go away. Because they've been crushed by these plagues, and especially by the last plague. We are now then at chapter 12. Chapter 12 of Exodus. And we are going to be talking about the departure from Egypt. I'm going to have to keep moving fairly quickly tonight because there's a lot that we need to cover in order to get through this. We're going to finish the book of Exodus today. For the most part, next week when we get together, the next chapter, chapter 8, is going to be drawing largely from the same book, but it's going to be talking specifically about the law that God reveals. We'll talk a little bit about that today. So chapter 12, verse 36. The Israelites set out from Ramses for Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, not counting the children. Now, I don't know why they didn't count the children. Reminds us of those passages in the New Testament when they have the feeding of the thousands, the multiplication of loaves, and so there were 4,000, not counting women and children. So, well, why not count women and children? What's that all about? But they don't. They would give us the exact number. But there are 600,000 of the Israelites, males, not counting the children. And then, along with that, a crowd of mixed ancestry also went up with them. Now, what is this group of mixed ancestry? Living there in Egypt for 400 years, many of the Hebrews had intermarried with the Egyptians, and as we talked about, there were a lot of other foreign groups that were present there in Egypt, and so there would have been a lot of intermarriage, and so there would have been, there are many who are not purely Hebrew, but they are Hebrew and Egyptian and Hebrew and whatever other kind of tribes and groups are there, and many of them are also leaving along with those who would have been a pure Hebrew ancestry. A crowd of mixed ancestry also went up with them, besides their livestock, very numerous flocks and herds. So, then he goes on and talks about the bread and the unleavened bread. We're not going to focus too much on that. They're going to make their way toward the Reed Sea. And one other thing I do need to talk about is the consecration of the firstborn, chapter 13. This is very important for us as Christians later on. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, consecrate to me every firstborn that opens a womb among the Israelites, both of man and beast, for it belongs to me. It belongs to me. Now, why does it belong to him? Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you came out of Egypt, that place of slavery. It was with a strong hand that the Lord brought you away. Nothing made with leaven may be eaten. The day of your departure is the month of Abib. Therefore, it is this month that you must celebrate this rite after the Lord your God has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, etc. Jump over to verse 11. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land of the Canaanites, which he swore to you and your fathers he would give you, you shall dedicate to the Lord every son that opens the womb, and all the male firstlings of your animals shall belong to the Lord. Every firstborn of an ass you shall redeem with a sheep. What's that mean? You will redeem. You'll buy it back. All right? So it's going to belong to God. So what's going to happen is they get into, especially into the temple system, and is that if I have a cow and she has a bull, the first one belongs to God. I have to take that and give it to the temple. All right, that's there to support the temple and the priests. Remember, the priests on the house of Levi, they do not have land, so they're not raising their own crops. They're not able to support themselves except through the generosity of the people. So the firstborn of every animal is going to be given to the temple, and then is going for the sacrifice, but then also for the support of those who work there. The firstborn child, male child, is also going to be given. Every firstborn of you were redeemed. If I have this cow and I or this bull, I'm going to give it, but I can redeem that with a sheep. All right, if I have a lamb, which is less expensive than a bull, then I can buy it back. All right, by giving the sheep. If you do not redeem it, you shall break its neck. All right, in other words, it has to become useless to you. Every firstborn son you must redeem. You must redeem. You have to buy your own first sons back. If your son, and where do we see this going on? The presentation of Jesus. When Mary and Joseph bring Jesus to the temple to present him, then what they are doing is that they are going to redeem him. It says that they offer the sacrifice, which for them was two birds because they were poor. That was a sacrifice of the poor. That's what they gave in order to buy back the son. Now, why do they have to buy back the son? Why do they have to redeem their son and these animals? If your son should ask you later on, what does this mean? You shall tell him, with a strong hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, that place of slavery. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, every firstborn of man and of beast. That is why I sacrifice to the Lord everything of the male sex that opens a womb, and why I redeem every firstborn of my sons. Because he's redeemed our children, they belong to God. He took the firstborn of the Egyptians. He spared ours. Therefore, every firstborn belongs to God. Let this be as a sign on your hand and as a pendant on your forehead, with a strong hand toward the Lord who brought us out of Egypt. So this is going to be important for when we talk about salvation, because we talk about redemption. And what is it that Christ is going to do? He is going to buy us back. He's going to buy us back. How's he going to do that? With his own death. Because of our sin, because of our rejection of God, we had fallen into slavery with Satan. We belonged to him. And so Christ is going to redeem us by his sacrifice. He is going to buy us back for God. Now, toward the Red Sea, and again, we're going to see that it's really the Reed Sea as we get into this. Now when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the Philistines' land. You have your book there. You look on page 138. There's a great map that shows you the route of the Exodus. We find the upper left-hand section there, Ramses. That's where they're coming from. It's in the scriptures say they went to Succoth. Then they go north, right? You see above the arrow where they went north, it has the Shihor Lake, but above there is the Reed Sea. The Reed Sea is a small body of water. It's a large lake, all right, is what we probably would call it, but they called it the Reed Sea. That is what is actually going to be separated. If you look down below, we have the Red Sea. The Red Sea is a huge sea. That is not what they are actually going to be crossing. It is the, and if you see the path, they're going to come down along the side of the Red Sea, but they're not going to cross it. So it is going to be the Reed Sea, even though for some reason, for hundreds of years, we have been translating that as the Red Sea. If you also notice then, you see the which is the Great Sea there on the very top, that's the Mediterranean. That's the Mediterranean Sea. And then just below that, we have a green line, and it says the way to the land of the Philistines. Now, the land of the Philistines is the land of Canaan, is the promised land. It's Israel. And that would have been the direct route, all right? So you see, if you'd followed that, you would come to Gaza. You hear the word Gaza, Gaza Strip, all right? That's what that is. You go a little bit further up there, and you are in Israel. That would have been the direct route. It would have been a couple of hundred miles, all right? They could have done it in a matter of weeks, if not a matter of a couple of months, moving that number of people. So, but it says that God did not lead them that way. Why not? Though this was the nearest, for he thought, should the people see that they would have to fight, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. That's not going to be an easy path. When they get in there, they're going to have to battle. Now, these are slaves. These are not warriors. These people have not been trained to be warriors. They have not learned what do you do, and they are not ready for that. And if they find out that they're going to have to fight, then they're going to turn and run back to Egypt and beg Pharaoh to forgive them and take them back. All right? In fact, you're going to see see them, this is what's going to take 40 years for them. It is going to take 40 years for this group of slaves to learn to think as free men and women. All right? You don't just stop being a slave. You don't just stop being a slave because you're set free. If you have been a slave all of your life, if you and your ancestors for generations have been slaves, that is going to shape the way you see yourself, the way you see life. You are going to be dependent in many ways. You're not going to be much of a self-starter. All right, there's a lot of things that aren't going to be there, and it's going to take 40 years for them to move out of the mentality of a slave to the mentality of a free man or a free woman. And so that's part of the transition. You know, in our own country, after the Civil War, this is part of the failure that took place after the Civil War, part of the failure of Reconstruction, was that these slaves were just turned loose. You know, they were just set free with nobody coming in and saying, okay, here, we're going to help you figure out, we're going to get you some education. We're going to teach you how to take care of yourself, how to make decisions which you've never been allowed to make all of your life. We're going to help you just do it. There was none of that. There was none of that. And within a very short time, there was a second form of slavery under Jim Crow laws that kind of came in that existed for decades up until the middle part of the 20th century, and that continued to enslave them, all right? And that they continued to think with the minds of slaves. I see this in dealing with people who are alcoholics and drug addicts who are just beginning recovery. You don't just take alcohol and drugs out of an alcoholic or drug addict's body and think that they're free. They're not. They're still thinking like an addict. They're still thinking like an alcoholic. And they have to go through what AA calls an entire psychic change. A psychic change to become really a new creation. This is what Jesus, when he talks about being born again, and St. Paul talks about becoming a new creation, it is taking on this new mindset, this new sense of reality, and that's going to take them 40 years. They're not ready for it, and so that's why God's not going to take them directly there. They're going to have to do a lot to learn how to be free. So he's not going to lead them to a direct route. Instead, he rerouted them toward the Red Sea by way of the desert road. In battle array, the Israelites marched out of Egypt. Moses also took Joseph's bones along, for Joseph had made the Israelites swear solemnly that when God should come to them, they would carry his bones away with them. Remember that? That was at the very end of the book of Genesis. Setting out from Succoth, they camped at Etham near the edge of the desert. The Lord preceded them in the daytime by means of a column of cloud to show them the way, and at night by means of a column of fire to give them light. It's probably the same column, you know, but it's just that you couldn't see the light during the daytime because it was drowned out by the light of the day. But so all they would see was the cloud. They're following that. But then at night, the glow would come from within the cloud. Thus they could travel both day and night. Neither the column of cloud by day nor the column of fire by night ever left its place in front of the people. Then we're going to jump down to, here in this beginning of chapter 14, what we're going to see is that Pharaoh and the people are going to change their minds again. They're like, what have we done? Our slaves are gone. What are we going to do? How are we going to replace all these people who were doing all the work that we needed done? So he is going to send his armies out after them. Verse 10, Pharaoh was already near when the Israelites looked up and saw that the Egyptians were on the march in pursuit of them. In great fright, they cried out to the Lord, and they complained to Moses, which they are going to do a lot. All right, this is the most... God is the great actor, and they are the great complainers. They are whiners. They are constantly whining and complaining against God, against Moses and Aaron. And it is going to be, that's going to be picked up actually in the New Testament. In the Bread of Life discourse in chapter 6 of John, where Jesus, when he is teaching them about himself as the bread of life and about how his flesh is real food, his blood is real drink, he's going to say that the crowd begins to murmur, all right, against him. It's picking up the language of Exodus. They complained to Moses, "Were there no burial places in Egypt that you had to bring us out of here to die in the desert? Why did you do this to us? Why did you bring us out of Egypt? Didn't we not tell you this in Egypt when we said, 'Leave us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians. Far better for us to be the slaves of the Egyptians than to die in the desert.'" They're not thinking like free men and women, all right? They have lived as slaves all their lives. They're comfortable being slaves. And now the cost of freedom is overwhelming them. They don't know what to do with this. But Moses answered the people, "Fear not, stand your ground, and you will see the victory of the Lord, that the Lord will win for you today. These Egyptians whom you see today, that you will never see again. The Lord himself will fight for you. You have only to keep still." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to go forward, and you, lift up your staff, and with hand outstretched over the sea, split the sea in two, that the Israelites may pass through it on dry land. But I will make the Egyptians so obstinate that they will go in after them. Then I will receive glory through Pharaoh and all his army, his chariots and charioteers. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I receive glory through Pharaoh and his chariots and charioteers." The angel of the Lord, who had been leading Israel's camp. Now this column is being referred to as an angel of the Lord. Now moved and went around behind them. All right, so now this column has moved in behind them. The column of cloud also, leaving the front, took up its place behind them so that it came between the camp of the Israelites and that of Israel. But the cloud now became dark. This is at night, so it's no longer lighting up the sky. And thus the night passed without the rival camps coming any closer together all night long. Then Moses stretched his arm over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea with a strong east wind through the night, and so turned it into dry land. When the water was thus divided, the Israelites marched into the midst of the sea on dry land, with the water like a wall to their right and to their left. The Egyptians followed in pursuit, while Pharaoh's horses and chariots and charioteers went after them right into the midst of the sea. And in the night watch, just before dawn, the Lord cast through the column of the fiery cloud upon the Egyptian force a glance that threw it into a panic. Now, we don't know what this looked like, but somehow God blasted them with some kind of a presence, of his presence, and they are overwhelmed by this and terrified, and they are panicked. And so they begin to run, and he clogged their chariot wheels that they could hardly drive, but that the Egyptians sounded the retreat before Israel, because the Lord was fighting for them against the Egyptians. They're not even fighting. They're running, all right? God's doing all the work here. Then the Lord told Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may flow back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and their charioteers." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at dawn the sea flowed back to its normal depth. The Egyptians were fleeing head on toward the sea when the Lord hurled them into its midst. As the water flowed back, it covered the chariots and the charioteers of Pharaoh's whole army, which had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not a single one of them escaped. The Israelites had marched on dry land to the midst of the sea, with the water like a wall to their right and to their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel on that day from the power of the Egyptians. When Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the seashore and beheld the great power that the Lord had shown through the Egyptians, they feared the Lord, as well they might, and believed in him and in his servant Moses. It's like, okay, we're convinced for the moment. For the moment, all right? Chapter 15, is called the Song of Moses. It's a great hymn that Moses sings after this great victory. We move over to chapter 16. They're going to move on. And we're going to get to some more murmuring here. Having set out from Elim, the whole Israelite community came into the desert of Shin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. Here in the desert, the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "Would that we had died at the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, as we sat by our flesh pots and ate our fill of bread." Remember how nice it was back in Egypt? Remember when we were slaves? Wasn't that wonderful? All right, we had plenty of food, and there really was. It was like, okay, at least we weren't starving to death. All right, and here we're out in the desert starving to death. But you had to lead us into the desert to make the whole community die of famine. Now, the quail and the manna. Then the Lord said to Moses, I will now rain down bread from heaven for you. Each day the people are to go out and gather their daily portion. That's an important phrase there, their daily portion. Thus will I test them to see whether they follow my instructions or not. Not. Always. Not. On the sixth day, however, when they prepare what they bring in, let it be twice as much as they gather on the other days, so that they're not working, they're not gathering on the Sabbath. At the other times, they're to gather only what they need for that day, and nothing more. So Moses and Aaron told all the Israelites, at evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord as he heeds your grumbling against him. But what are we that you should grumble against us? When the Lord gives you flesh to eat in the evening, continued Moses, and in the morning you're full of bread as he heeds the grumbling you utter against him, what then are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, tell the whole Israelite community, present yourselves before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. When Aaron, it's like children, isn't it? All right. When Aaron announced this to the whole Israelite community, they turned toward the desert, and lo, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, in the evening twilight you shall eat flesh. This is going to be the quail. And in the morning you shall have your fill of bread, the manna, so that you may know that I, the Lord, am your God. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp and somehow landed there. And they were able to get the quail and eat the quail, so they have flesh. In the morning, a dew lay all about the camp. And when the dew evaporated, there on the surface of the desert were fine flakes like hoarfrost on the ground. On seeing it, the Israelites asked one another, what is this? For they did not know what it was. But Moses told them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Okay, so he's giving them bread in the morning, and he's giving them flesh, quail, in the evening. Now we're going to have some regulations about the manna. Now this is what the Lord has commanded. So gather it that everyone has enough to eat, an omer for each person, as many of you as there are, each man providing for those of his own tent. The Israelites did so. Some gathered a large and some a small amount. But when they measured out by the omer, he who had gathered a large amount did not have too much, and he who had gathered a small amount did not have too little. They so gathered that everyone had enough to eat. Moses also told them, let no one keep any of it over until tomorrow morning. But they would not listen to him. No. What Moses is saying is like, listen, God's going to give you more tomorrow. And they're saying, we're not counting on that. We're not counting on that at all. All right? We're going to take, if it's here, we're going to gather it up. But some kept a part of it over to the following morning and became wormy and rotten. Therefore, Moses was displeased with them. There is a prayer that Jesus taught us called the Lord's Prayer. And in the midst of the Lord's Prayer, there is a prayer that you and I pray all the time. Give us this day our daily bread. This is clearly connected here. All right? But we don't really mean it any more than they meant it. All right? We do not want God to give us this day our daily bread. We want God to give us an insurance policy. All right? We want God to give us enough that we can save up for a rainy day. All right? So we do not want to have to learn to live one day at a time, trusting in the mercy and the compassion and the generosity of God. We do not want that. We simply do not. But that is what we pray for every time we pray the Lord's Prayer. Is, Lord, give me today what I want, what I need for today. And again, what is it we really want? We want a portfolio. All right, that's really what we want, is a portfolio, to make sure that I don't have to rely upon God day after day after day. I want to be able to rely upon myself. I want to be able to rely upon my savings, upon my insurance policies, upon my portfolio, and my pension fund and all these. This is what I truly want to trust in. And he's trying to teach them, as these newly freed human beings, to trust God one day at a time. Lord, just give me today what I need today. And then tomorrow, give me what I need again tomorrow. And learning to really trust God. But trusting God is scary. Because we're not really sure he can be trusted. We are not really sure that he's going to take care of us every day. Are we? Honestly. Doesn't that scare you a little bit? It scares me a whole lot. Okay, so I mean, I just think it's important to know that. We're going to move on. In chapter 17, it talks about the water from the rock, and we're not going to go into that, but again, what is that God provides them. They're complaining, they're whining again, they're murmuring because they're thirsty, and he gives them water from the rock. In chapter 17, verse 8, we see what's referred to as the battle with Amalek. And I'm not going to read through that either, but it's a great story. You're familiar with the story. There is a great battle that is going on between the Israelites and the Amalekites. And Moses is praying, because who's the one that really wins their victories? It's God. And so Moses stands praying with his hands in prayer. And as long as his arms are lifted up in prayer, then the Israelites are winning the battle. But of course, if you've ever held your arms like this, you know that they get tired pretty quickly, and when he drops his arms, the Amalekites begin winning the battle. So finally what they do is they have him sit on a rock, all right, and they have two guys holding his arms up, and they end up winning the battle. There's a great, powerful truth that's in this, all right, about our need to trust in God, all right, that it is God who fights our battles for us, all right, and that we need, now certainly we have to do our part, as the Israelites were down there doing their part in the midst of the battle, but we must be people of prayer. All right, we must be people of prayer who allow God to win the victories for us. We're going to jump now to chapter 19, where we are now at the covenant at Mount Sinai. This is the heart. This is the heart of the whole thing. In the third month after their departure from the land of Egypt on its first day, the Israelites came to the desert of Sinai. After the journey from Rephidim to the desert of Sinai, they pitched camp. Well, Israel was encamped here in front of the mountain. At this point, this is just a nice, pretty mountain. Nothing special about this mountain, just a nice mountain. Moses went up the mountain to God. There the Lord called to him and said, "Thus you say to the house of Jacob, to the Israelites, you have seen for yourselves how I treated the Egyptians, and how I bore you up on eagle's wings and brought you here to myself. Therefore, if you hearken to my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my special possession. If you just do what I tell you, if you'll just trust me, I'm going to take care of you. I got your back, all right? I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to provide for you. There's going to be nothing you need to be worried about if you just trust me. If you hearken to my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my special possession, dearer to me than all other people, though all the earth is mine. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation." Now, he's going to give them a priesthood, all right, that's going to operate. But he's saying also all of you in a certain way are a kingdom of priests. Those who can, you don't have to wait for a priest in order to come to me. You can come and talk to me anytime. You can have a relationship with me. That is what you must tell the Israelites. So Moses went and summoned the elders of the people. When he set before them all that the Lord had ordered him to tell them, the people all answered, saying, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Then Moses brought back to the Lord the response of the people. The Lord also told him, "I am coming to you in a dense cloud, so that when the people hear me speaking with you, they may always have faith in you also." When Moses then had reported to the Lord the response of the people, the Lord added, "Go to the people and have them sanctify themselves today and tomorrow. Make them wash their garments." He's going to tell them, you've got to purify yourself over the next few days to get ready for this. One of the things he's going to tell them is, do not come close to the mountain, all right? You do not come and touch the mountain. The only person who's going to be allowed up here is going to be Moses. So do not even come to the base of the mountain. Don't let any of the animals come up onto the mountain. If they do, they have to be killed. They have to be killed. If any person comes up there, they have to be killed. I'm serious about this. Don't come up on the mountain. All right? So we're going to go down to verse 16, the great theophany. And a theophany, theo, means God. It's a Greek word for God. Theophany is a manifestation of God. It is an experience of the living presence of God. On the morning of the third day, there were peals of thunder and lightning. Remember, this was just a nice, cute mountain up until today. All right? They wake up, and something different is happening on this mountain. There were peals of thunder and lightning and a heavy cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast that all the people in the camp trembled. But Moses led the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stationed themselves at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was all wrapped in smoke, for the Lord came down upon it in fire. The smoke rose from it as from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. What are we dealing with here? This is a volcano. This is a volcano. But these people don't know a volcano. They don't have the Discovery Channel. They've never read National Geographic. They don't know what a volcano is. They just are like, we've seen mountains before, but mountains that we've seen never do this. This is God. This is God. Now, I want to take a moment here and reflect on this. There are those, especially in the last century, in the 20th century, scripture scholars who were into what was called demythologizing the scriptures. And what they were doing is they went through and they said, okay, we're going to take away anything that looks miraculous. We're going to say, well, this is what it really was. All right. And so, you know, it was, and so they're explaining away all the plagues. They're explaining away the miracles of Jesus. And they're certainly explaining away this great theophany. And they're saying, this is a very ancient people, very unsophisticated, very unscientific, and so they're looking at this mountain, this volcano, and they think that it's God. Aren't they silly? Right, clearly it was not God. Clearly it was not God. Who's right? The Israelites were right. Because what the Israelites possessed, and that the demythologizers did not possess, was sacramental vision. All right, sacramental vision. This is a basic principle of Catholic theology, is the sacramental principle that all sacred reality, all divine reality is mediated to us human beings through material methods. All right, God uses the material to make himself present to us. In the sacraments, we have water, which makes present for us the Holy Spirit, and we have the bread and wine, which makes present for us the body and the blood of the Lord. All through the sacraments, they all have there's an outward sign which is used by God to mediate his grace, to mediate his presence. Now, when they look up there, is that a volcano? Yes, yes. But God is using that volcano to mediate his presence to them. He is speaking to them through the volcano. He is reaching out to them and revealing himself to them through the volcano. And they look at this and they're in awe. This experience of wonder and awe as they see this. It's terrifying, the power of God, the majesty of God, the glory of God that they are experiencing there. But you know what? What they see there, the power, you can imagine. I've never been I was in Hawaii, but it's just a lava flow. I never saw like the explosion of a volcano, but I can imagine what that must be. But when you think in terms of the whole universe and all of the sun of the universe, the billions and billions of suns, and the power, the energy that is here present in this universe, and the God who created all of that, who is greater than all of that, that volcano is like a matchstick, all right, compared to who God really is. All right, God is much more than that. But that's what they're experiencing. They're experiencing the wonder and the majesty and the awe and the glory of God. So Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, for the Lord came down upon it. The fire rose from it as though from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. The trumpet blast grew louder and louder while Moses was speaking, and God answered him with thunder. So Moses is there, and he is praying, he is speaking to God, and then the mountain is roaring back. God is roaring. Can you imagine this dialogue? All right, this dialogue that's going on, and people are watching, and they're seeing Moses shouting out these prayers and these praises of God, and the mountain is speaking back to him, all right, in this, in the thunder, in the earthquakes that are going on. When the Lord came down to the top of Mount Sinai, he summoned Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up to him. Then the Lord told Moses, go down and warn the people not to break through toward the Lord in order to see him. Otherwise, many of them will be struck down. The priests, too, who approach the Lord must sanctify themselves. So the priests are going to be allowed in, but they have to sanctify, purify themselves, else he will vent his anger upon them. Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot go up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us to set limits around the mountain to make it sacred. Moses Moses is arguing with God. All right? God says, go down and tell him this. Oh, don't worry, Lord. We've already taken care of it. The Lord repeated, go down now. You ever said that to your kids? If you told them to do something and they tell you why they shouldn't have to do it now. Go down now. Then come up again along with Aaron. But the priests and the people must not break through to come up to the Lord, else he will vent his anger upon them. So Moses went down to the people and told them this. Then he comes back up to God. Then God delivered all these commandments, the Ten Commandments. We're not going to go into all of these. You know what they are. We spent last year, as we talked about the moral teaching of the church, we spent the entire year talking about the Ten Commandments. Certainly you want to go through and read them and reflect on them, but we need to talk about them. That's what I want to do, is to talk about these Ten Commandments. And again, the demythologizers would say, you know, Moses went up there and he prayed and he just kind of came up with these Ten Rules, and he was the one that actually chiseled out the tablets and brought that down, and he said, this is what God gave to me, all right? But God really didn't give it to him. This was just Moses came up with these because he was a wise leader, and so he came up with all this on his own, all right? Now, I would say maybe there's some truth in the way in which they're describing it, but it was God who gave it to Moses. Now, did he really send lightning down to carve out the tablets? I don't know. I'm not going to get lost in all of that. But these come from God. These are revealed to Moses by God. These commandments, we're talking about commandments that were given around 3,500 years ago. 3,500 years ago. And the genius of these is absolutely immense, is absolutely astounding. One of the things that you do not see in religion up until this point is a merging of religion and morality. Now, because of the Ten Commandments, we've always associated religion and morality, all right? Almost to the point that sometimes we think it's all about morality and we forget that it's really about a relationship with God. But for most of the pagan peoples, and remember, they're just emerging from this pagan world, the gods were not demanding that the people be moral. The gods weren't moral. Read the stories of Jupiter and Hera and all of it. I mean, they were not moral, so they were not in the least bit concerned with whether or not human beings were moral or not. What they wanted was to be adored. They wanted sacrifice. And so there is this worship that was part of all of these religions. But morality was not clear. There was morality that was being taught, but it was more out of civic, what's good for the people, what's good for us. As philosophy begins to emerge, and there's the teaching of ethics. But Moses is the one that brings us together and says, this is a God whose number one concern is morality, is that we be a moral people. He is concerned, not, in fact, later on with the prophets, we're going to have come to a time when the Israelites are offering sacrifices. The temple is just going great guns. But there's great corruption that is going on throughout the entire people. But the people are still offering sacrifice, but they're not taking care of the widows and the orphans. They're not doing the things that they're supposed to do. And God's going to say to the prophets, do you really think this is what I'm about? Do you think I need your bowls? Do you think I eat them? Do you think I'm hungry? Do you think if I was hungry, I would come to you and ask you to fix something for me? I, who have made the entire universe, if I get hungry, I'll go take care of it myself. I don't need you to do that for me. What I want is a heart that is akin to my own. I want someone who is committed to justice, to doing the truth. That's what I demand. The prophets are going to tell us that we are not merely to circumcise our bodies, but to circumcise our hearts. That's what God wants. God is calling us for a transformation. This is the genius. This is the genius of what is going on here. Is that there is a new collision between religion and morality. And God is revealing. And these Ten Commandments still stand. And as I said, last year when we talked about the morality section of the church's teaching in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, what she still uses are the Ten Commandments as kind of the tree that she hangs all of her moral teaching on. Essentially, everything we even need to know today about morality is at least in seminal form, all right, revealed there in the Ten Commandments. We've got it all. We've got it all. All the issues that still need to be discussed. Now, there certainly are new insights and new discoveries but those are the principles that still guide us and still direct us, are the Ten Commandments. The first three, which, of course, guide our relationship with God. What are we supposed to do? We're supposed to honor this one God, follow this one God, because there are no others. And you shall not have any false gods before me. You shall keep holy my name. You shall not use my name in vain, and you shall keep holy the Lord's day. So he wants us to have a relationship with him and prayer with him. And then with the other commandments that govern our lives together, to govern the way in which we deal with each other in terms of respect for human life, respect for property, respect for marriage and for sexuality, integrity, all of these things, which are still, these are the core values. These are the core values. And that this man, Moses, would have gone up there and come up with this on his own 3,500 years ago, when nothing like this had ever appeared before. That he just dreamt it up on his own. No way. This was revealed by God. This was given by God. So we have the Ten Commandments. We're also going to see, and this is what we're getting into next week when we talk about the law, that he's going to reveal more than the Ten Commandments. The heart of the Jewish religion was the law. And so we're going to see there's a lot of laws. Just looking in the next few pages, we have laws regarding slaves, regarding personal injury, property damage, trusts and loans, social laws, religious laws. When we get to the book of Leviticus, that entire book is a book of laws concerning the priests and the Levites and the offering of the sacrifices and the various religious rites and ceremonies. We're going to get to Deuteronomy, which means the second law, which is going to give us even more. So there is a lot of law here. There's a lot of law that is going to be laid out for us here. We're not going to get into each and every detail of that, but it was not just the Ten Commandments. It was much more than that. So Moses is going to receive that. But then in verse 18, after the Ten Commandments, when the people witnessed the thunder and lightning, the trumpet blast, and the mountain smoking, they all feared and trembled. So they took up a position much farther away and said to Moses, "You speak to us, and we will listen. But let not God speak to us, or we shall die." God, tell him to be quiet. He scares us to death. All right? And so that's what that, so Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid, for God has come to you only to test you and put his fear upon you, lest you should sin." So the people remained at a distance while Moses approached the cloud where God was. So we're going to stop. This is where we're going to stop. This is where we're going to stop. Is after this great theophany, after this great experience of God on the mountain and the revelation of the Ten Commandments. Next week we'll be pulling from some of the other books as well when we talk about the law, and we'll get into things like the golden calf and some of the things that we're very familiar with that are not listed here in the book of Exodus. I wanted to also just point out one more thing. I forgot to do this as I was going through. This is in chapter 11 of the book of Numbers. And it is, remember we were talking about the quail, right? And this retells that story of God giving the quail. This is the book of Numbers, chapter 11, verse 31. I love this. Excuse me. It's 11, 18 to 20. This is where I want to go. So the people have been whining and complaining because they're hungry, and to the people, however, you shall say, "Sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, when you shall have some meat to eat. For in the hearing of the Lord you have cried, 'Would that we had meat for food.'" He's already given them the bread, but now they're wanting meat. "Oh, how well off we were in Egypt when we were slaves." Remember the good old days when we were slaves. "Therefore the Lord will give you meat for food, and you will eat it, not for one day, or 2 days, or 5, or 10, or 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you." Isn't that wonderful? I love that. You're going to eat it till it's coming out your nose. That's what you. I am so. You know, he's saying, "I'm so sick of you. You're going to eat it till you get sick, till you cannot stand it anymore. For you have spurned the Lord who is in your midst, and in his presence you have wailed. Why did we ever leave Egypt?" Okay. So I need to share that with you because I just think that's so wonderful. All right. We've got a few minutes for questions, comments. Jim. Speak up.
Tomorrow is the fifth turn.
Okay, tomorrow night we're beginning. How many weeks is it? How many weeks?
Six.
6 weeks. Tomorrow night here at MacArthur Mary, we're beginning a program called Catholics Returning Home. If there's someone that you know who is kind of thinking about returning to the church, this is a program that's intended to help them with that, to get the chance to get to know them, to find out what their needs are, what their questions are, and to kind of support them in that journey back. So that's going to be here tomorrow at 7 o'clock. And where are we going to be meeting, Jim?
Room
206 down this way. Okay. So if you know somebody, please invite them. Okay. Why do they switch back and forth between angel and God and God? Okay. At this point, again, we're at the very beginnings, and they have not worked a lot of things out. And so, you know, we saw this in the book of Genesis, too, where on one hand, it says that Joshua is wrestling with an angel of the Lord, and the next moment, he's wrestling with the Lord himself, and that at this point, they are not really seeing angels as created beings, but as somehow a manifestation of God's presence and God's glory. All right. It's going to be as they move along, as we move along in the history of Israel, that they are going to develop really, not so much in the Bible, but in some of their other writings, they're going to develop a very complex angelology. All right. But that's going to take time. At this point, they're just not there yet. We've got to understand that here, they are emerging from the darkness, and they're trying to grasp this as best they can and put it into the language that they have, and it's like a kindergartner trying to explain calculus. All right, it's like, okay, you're telling me this, and now I'm trying my best I can to express what this is about, but I'm limited because of my language.
You're saying something about the time that I'm in the world. I guess if God moves, maybe it comes to continuation of what we said with our morals of this day and time, since they are falling down.
They've always fallen down. You know history. You know, we look at the Hebrew people, and you know God says, if you just listen to me and do what I tell you to do, if you just follow my covenant, then I will take care of you. I will bless you. And the whole history of Israel is that Israel is unfaithful and God is faithful. But guess what? The history of Christianity is, we are unfaithful and God is faithful. All right, and so you know every generation has decried the loose morals, especially of those who were younger. All right, and certainly we see that there's a real loss of morality here, but it's not the first time. It's not the first time in the history of Christianity that we've seen this. So it does not mean we're at the end of something. You know, it just means that there is a need for another conversion, a renewal of faith in our own time to rediscover those morals. Essentially, probably what will happen, as has happened in the past, is that morals decline, we end up in crisis, and in crisis, we start turning back to God, all right, and we start embracing His truth. This is exactly what happens all the way through the history of the Old Testament, but it is the history of Christianity too. That we get close to God, then we start drifting away. We create a mess. We start trying to get close to God again, and then we create a mess, and then we get comfortable, and we start drifting away. And you know, it's just we human beings are not good at faithfulness. We just aren't. So. He's real good at it. All right. Okay, next week we're going to be chapter 8, which is going to deal with the law. Let's stand and close with prayer. There we go. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil. Amen.
Thank you all. See you next week. By the way, there are schedules back there for the rest of this semester, up through May.